Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 182, I chat with Alan Brown of CinemaQuest about the importance of the room in viewing video. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded November 11th, 2013. Episode 182. The Room is a Video Component. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Hulu Plus. Hulu Plus lets you binge on thousands of hit shows anytime, anywhere on your TV, PC, smartphone, or tablet. Visit HuluPlus.com/HTG to start your free 2-week trial. That's HuluPlus.com/HTG. And by Ting.com. Ting is a mobile phone service that makes sense. Save money with Ting. Pay for what you use. It doesn't require a contract, and it offers unlimited devices on one account. To save $25 on your first Ting device, visit htg.ting.com. That's htg.ting.com. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the home theater geek and director of content at avsforum.com. This week's guest geek is Alan Brown, the founder and president of CinemaQuest, which is a company that deals with the viewing environment. And we're going to talk all about that on this show. Hey, Alan, welcome.
Hi, Scott. It's a pleasure to be with you on this Veterans Day, 2013.
Yes, thank you all, veterans, for your service. And today we're going to be talking about the viewing environment. Now, I've done several shows about acoustics and how the room is really to be considered another audio component. But this is the first time that I've really focused on the room as a video component. And it's just as critical for the video viewing experience as it is for the audio listening experience, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. Always has been.
Now, you're a home theater designer and a consultant and a builder. You founded CinemaQuest in 1998, I believe.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you're an ISF and THX certified calibrator and a member of SMPTE, the Society of Motion Picture and Television Engineers, and the Digital Cinema Society as well. So you're deeply ensconced in the whole area of how does the picture look.
I am a geek with all caps.
A serious home theater geek. Well, that's why you're on our show. So you call yourself an image fidelity advocate. What exactly does that mean?
Well, it has a lot to do with the fact that if we had no programming, video wouldn't be worth much. And it's that programming that brought me to the field, because I have loved movies since my childhood. My mom took me to movies when I was young, and I just loved the format and the experience. And as home theater became a viability with Laserdisc and pre-recorded movies on tape and so on, larger TVs and surround sound, my interest just moved in that direction, because I wanted to have those movies in my house instead of having to wait for them to appear in a commercial cinema. And image fidelity gets us back to the experience, the viewing experience that the program creators, the content providers, the cinematographers and directors and artists who make these wonderful movies, that it gets us back to what they intended for us to see. And one of the things I've learned since entering the profession is that cinematographers take great pains to work on even the most subtle of details when they photograph a movie. And if the video system that plays movies in the home is not optimized, is not designed, installed, and calibrated correctly, you can lose a lot of those subtleties and never realize that emotional impact that the cinematographer was going for in cooperation with a director.
Now, certainly calibrating the TV, we've talked about on the show quite a bit, is one element of that. You know, you want to make sure that the TV is reproducing the right color of white and the right color of red, green, and blue, and so on. But the room itself has a surprising amount of impact on the perception of what you see on the screen, even if it is fully and accurately calibrated.
Well, in calibration, I've been promoting, mentioning, emphasizing for years that calibration should always be understood in light of a system approach. And you can't just calibrate a display and deliver accurate imaging to the viewer, because there are a lot more elements to how that image gets to the eyes of the viewer that impact how it looks, and all the associated hardware, the Blu-ray player, the cable box, et cetera, the interconnect cables. What we're looking at today is also how the room is designed, how the room is lit, what colors are in the field of view with the display, and so on. Those things all can have an effect on how the audience, the viewer, perceives the image, the program, the art. As Joe Kane insists on repeating, it's all about the art, really, in proper display studies. We're trying to convey image fidelity. We're trying to deliver a work of art, especially in home theater, which this is Home Theater Geeks, isn't it?
Absolutely.
In home theater, we're talking about cinema, and cinema is an art form. It is moving art and moving images accompanied by sound and sound effects. And we want to deliver that to the audience as unaltered or diluted or distorted as possible.
Right. Taylor Karras in the chat room is saying, and rightly so, I guess that by having some reflection on the walls, the light can get messed up. And it's not that the light gets messed up, but your perception gets messed up.
Yeah, it gets a little tricky for people to keep all these things straight. There are two ways that light can affect how the image on a display appears. One is the actual physical characteristics of light striking the front of the set, or in many cases, a front projection setup. As light hits the screen, it can literally, physically tint the image. But the color of that light and what it illuminates in addition to the image on the screen within the field of view of the viewer, that can have a perceptual effect on how that viewer sees the image on the screen. So it's both a physical light striking the screen, then the color of that light and how it illuminates surrounding objects, and what the visual cortex in the brain does to interpret how that appears in relation to the image on the screen as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, Before we get into that, and we do have some graphics to illustrate what you just said, but we'll talk about that a little more deeply in a moment. I wanted you to just go over briefly sort of the history of imaging science in the home theater.
Well, this is a fascinating subject to me. It always has been since I became aware of it. I was an audiophile for many years, and as I mentioned earlier, I became a videophile when movies became available on TVs. And I was visiting a small brick-and-mortar consumer electronics store in Fort Wayne, Indiana years ago, and he had some back issues of Perfect Vision magazine. And I picked one up, and I was just looking through it, and I noticed this article by Joe Kane about how to adjust a TV picture. And I bought that back issue and another issue or two while I was there, and I became aware of Joe Kane's mission, which began as the chair of the SMPTE Professional Monitor Working Group a few years prior to that, where the Society of Motion Picture and Television Engineers recognized that our NTSC system was essentially never twice the same color.
And yes.
That was the humorous reference of the day to what NTSC meant rather than National Television Systems Committee. And they put together this panel of experts, and they did the research into how displays work, how televisions work, and also how human factors define the viewer's perception of images on televisions. And they published a couple of articles at the end of their research, a couple of recommended practices documents. SMPTE RP 166 and 167. 166 dealt with the viewing environment conditions that were necessary to standardize how images appeared on TV monitors. And then 167 was how to calibrate those monitors. And that was the roots of the imaging science movement, if you will, that was really cooking back in the late 80s, early 90s in the video industry.
Which then led Joe and Joel Silver to found the Imaging Science Foundation.
Exactly. The SMPTE Working Group commissioned Joe, because he was had proven himself a good spokesperson, to go out into the world and to spread the gospel of video standards and imaging science. And that resulted in his founding, along with Joel Silver, the current president of the Imaging Science Foundation, that group to educate both the industry and consumers into video standards and display industry best practices, and what the reason why they wanted Joe to spread this word was because they wanted people that were their intended audience to see the same quality of pictures that they were seeing at the broadcast and at the program production end of the process.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, televisions, what people were buying in the stores were far from accurate. Most of them had very blue grayscales and white points and all kinds of tricky little gizmos and gadgets to try and correct for blue skin with color flesh tone compensation circuits and things like that.
Yeah.
And gradually over the years, because of Joe Kane's work and Joel Silver and the Imaging Science Foundation, more and more people became aware of what to demand from TV manufacturers to give them correct pictures.
Which we now see commonly, at least if not in the out-of-the-box mode, then the cinema or movie mode of most TVs gets relatively close to accurate. Those that are THX certified also get quite close to being accurate, which means to be following these system standards, which you referred to earlier, that Joe and others helped develop.
Image fidelity.
Now, there's this, we'll just mention briefly here that there's a summary of all of this. A widescreen review published a special edition called Imaging Science Theater 2000, which is out of print, but you can get the PDF by going to shop.widescreenreview.com and, navigating in there to Imaging Science Theater 2000, which will give you that article plus copies of SMPTE 166 and 167. So one can really geek out on that sort of stuff. I think you mentioned here in the notes I got from you, it cost $10, but, you know, $10 to a geek for this kind of geeky information is probably well worth it.
If you order the two SMPTE documents from SMPTE, you're looking at $40.
Ah.
Just for that. And there's over 300 pages of wonderful... very fundamental, foundational imaging science principles, and some of the early history of how we transitioned from the never twice the same color NTSC system to images and equipment that were actually giving us closer to correct pictures.
Right, exactly right. Chumley in the chat room is asking, I guess once the lights go down, the color of the room doesn't really matter. make it black. Make it black. Now, there have been a couple people in the chat room who've been talking about painting the room black or dark gray, which is what I certainly did in the two video studios that I created in order to review televisions, and also in my own home theater. It's painted with what's called a Munsell neutral gray with about 9% reflectivity. So it's quite dark. We actually have a picture of the Munsell grayscale, which is a chip chart, essentially, a painting chip chart. There it is, which you can see it's a very special chip chart that has neutral colors from white to black. And that is, I think, will you agree with me that is kind of the ideal color that you want the walls to be, or rather lack of color?
Ideal, yes. There are ways to add some color in the room. I cover some of these issues in articles at my website, but there are ways to use nearly neutrals, which are essentially desaturated colors like pastels and softer colors. You can use those in rooms. You look in most residential dwellings today, and that's basically what's being used is whites, off-whites, and maybe there'll be a little bit of brown or a little bit of blue or a little bit of green mixed in with the white. Mm-hmm. And those are typical interior colors. Nearly white, of course, in most cases. And you can do some of this in areas, other walls, other surfaces in the rooms, like carpet and the other walls. But the wall around a direct view display, like a plasma or LCD or a rear projection TV, should be truly neutral. And that will help preserve correct color perception of the image on the screen.
And neutral and dark, I think would you agree?
Not necessarily.
Oh, really?
There are other principles involved. When you study human visual perception, you can actually enhance the perceived contrast of the image on the TV if the area within your field of view is lighter rather than darker.
Okay. Terry K in the chat room asks, does color calibration of the cinema device, meaning the display, I assume, interact with the room color such that not all environments will optimize with the Munsell gray?
Not sure I follow that.
Well, I guess he's asking, is Munsell gray always going to be the ideal best thing to paint the walls, or will in some cases will that maybe not be the best thing to use?
Neutral is always best.
Yeah. That's what I would have said as well. Okay, so we've talked a little bit about the wall colors, and actually we have a picture of what you might think of as a horror story, which is a flat panel TV on a red wall with an orange or yellow painting on it. There it is. Tell us, what's wrong with this picture?
Well, isn't this curious? What happens is any color that's near the TV screen, what happens perceptually in the visual cortex is that color will be perceptually subtracted from the image on the screen. So you've got a little yellow being subtracted here, and you've got a lot of red being subtracted. And if you put a calibration instrument on that TV, even back it away several feet, if it's the right kind of instrument, it will not register that color shift. It occurs entirely in the brain. And this particular room that I found in a magazine is more common than you may think, where you see the rest of the room is neutral white. And it's so funny with interior decorators. They get it completely backwards. When you design decor for video viewing environments, it's not business as usual. And this room is entirely neutral except the one wall that needs to be neutral.
That should be neutral.
Yes. So I find this one particularly humorous.
Yeah. Now, you pointed me to a great online demo of how nearby colors can, in fact, affect your perception of color in a very dramatic way. It's a company called eChalk, eChalk, in the UK. And they've got some incredible demos here that we're going to show. So I think we can either go to View Illusions. There's one. tell us what we're looking at.
Well, what we have here is actually a combination of illusions. But the primary one that we're concerned about is how surrounding an object of focus with a vivid color will skew your color perception. If you look at these two objects, the center of each object.
So, and the objects are basically sort of, they look like X's built up of some sort of building blocks sitting on top of a black and white checkerboard. I just want to make sure that those who aren't being able to see this can sort of understand. And what we want to be looking at, those of you who can see it, we want to be looking at the central piece of the X where the two lines cross. It's basically the intersection point, the middle of the X.
Those two segments, for most people who don't have color blindness issues, the segment in the middle of the yellow field looks sort of purplish and dark. The segment in the middle of the blue field looks yellow and lighter. Actually, they are absolutely identical.
And one can't believe that until one moves the slider on the website. And when you do, as we are doing now, bingo.
When you take away that surrounding color, you see those center segments as they naturally are. And one thing that's interesting with this slider is when you adjust it just down to where the surrounding fields are more pastel, it's still, even with very light coloration, it will still skew your perception of that center segment.
It sure does. And it's amazing. What's amazing to me is that that's all happening in the brain.
Yes, entirely in the brain. Because even now that you know what's going on and you add the color back in, it's impossible for you to see those center segments as identical.
Yep, quite remarkable. There are a couple other demos on that same page that show much the same thing. Let's take a quick look at them. So here's a Rubik's Cube type of a thing, again, with a yellow field and a blue field. And you take and you make the tinting opaque, and you'll see that the center or the certain squares on the top face look to be, they are the same color. They're gray, basically. And when you put the image back together again, they still look about the same. But at some point, the ones on the right are going to start looking yellow because of the blue tint.
Yep.
Quite remarkable.
When I rejoiced when I found this demonstration, because I had understood these principles theoretically, but I didn't have a way to demonstrate them like this. And Dr. R. Bolotto, interesting name, but he is he has put this website together. He teaches at a university in England. He's actually spoken before the TED conference for the you geeks that are familiar with.
I'm sure most of us are Ted, and certainly familiar with Ted. Yeah,
Ted heads,
indeed.
But these are just fascinating. There's a whole lot of other visual tricks that he demonstrates on the site, but they don't apply directly to what we're talking about today, which is how surrounding a TV with a colored area, the wall or a cabinet or whatever, can actually distort your color perception, even if that display is perfectly calibrated. You cannot see accurate color on that TV if you surround it with non-neutral areas.
So if you're thinking about making a home theater, one of the things you want to think about is painting the wall directly behind the display a neutral color. Get that Munsell chip chart and don't paint it bright red or maroon or something like that, as we saw in the previous picture. That Munsell chip chart, which, by the way, I must tell you, I have one myself, which I bought from Munsell. And when we get the camera back on me, we can see that here it is right here. Let me try and pull it up here. So I've got the chip chart right here, and you can see I marked with a big pink marker the level of black that or gray right there that I chose for my home theater, which my wife, when we moved into this house, I got to do the home theater and my office, and she got to decorate the rest of the house. So I thought that was fair, but that's certainly
the way we do it at my house.
And exactly so. Okay, so we've talked about room color. Next we want to talk about lighting. But before we do, I hope you will excuse me for just a moment while I take a moment to thank our new sponsor for this episode, one which I hope will be a longtime sponsor because it's so perfect, so appropriate to home theater geeks, and that is Hulu Plus. Now, most of you know about Hulu, of course. It's an online source of streaming content. And at Hulu, you can get a lot of content on your computer. But what Hulu Plus does and what's so cool about it is that it lets you get even more content on anything that has a Hulu app. So I've got it on my iPad, I've got it on my Blu-ray player. Most TVs these days and most Blu-ray players have Hulu Plus apps on them, which lets you stream thousands of TV shows and a selection of movies on your television or on your mobile device, whatever you have. Now, many of you probably tried Hulu.com, but I really wouldn't want to encourage you to try Hulu Plus because it streams HD, and you can watch it on any device, and you can also get exclusive content that isn't available anywhere else. All this for only $7.99 a month, $7.99 a month for Hulu Plus, wherever you go on whatever device you care to watch it on. I've been catching up, by the way, on Nova Science Now, the PBS series that has been hosted up till recently by Neil deGrasse Tyson, one of my favorite TV hosts and an astrophysicist. And I've been catching up on some of the episodes I missed, and that's been really, really cool. Now, right now, you can try Hulu Plus free for 2 weeks when you go to HuluPlus.com/HTG for Home Theater Geeks. And that's a special offer for our listeners, so I really hope you'll check it out and take advantage of those 2 free weeks from Hulu Plus. Make sure you go to Hulu Plus, that's P-L-U-S spelled out, HuluPlus.com/HTG, so you get the extended free trial, and they know that we sent you, which I hope you will do. And we thank Hulu Plus very much for their support of the TWiT Network and Home Theater Geeks, and we do hope you will enjoy watching instantly with Hulu Plus. So, like I said, we were talking about paint and wall color. Now let's talk about lighting, the environment, the ambient light in your room, which is also an extremely important aspect of how the room is really one of the components of your video system.
Yes. I think intuitively, those of us who watch televisions know that sometimes if you turn a certain lamp on in the room, it can kind of take over the picture on the screen if the screen is very reflective. And so we just never turn that light on when we watch TV. That's a simple element to understand that the lighting can affect a number of things, actually. And one of them deals with reflections. And a lot of, I think probably the majority of the home theater geeks out there have flat panel TVs rather than projection setups. And flat panel TVs more and more have been sold with glossy, pretty reflective screens. And
sounds like you're getting a call there. I hope you can mute that.
I thought it was you.
I'm not calling you. I'm talking to you right now.
In fact, I'm going to put this on the mode it should have been on.
There you go.
The other element is light that doesn't necessarily reflect directly in the screen. If it's just present in the room, like from a window off to the side or something, can still interfere with the picture. It can set up.
We have a couple of problems. We have a couple of graphics to demonstrate that.
Yes.
From NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Tables.
Technology. Okay. Standards and technology.
So one of them is the reflective characteristics. And I hope I named the file well enough for John to find it and put it up. We'll talk about, I think both of them are, have the word NIST in them, so in the file name, so they should be relatively easy to pull up. It was in the folder that I sent you.
We
may not be able to pull that up after all.
Well, this information is available on my website as well, and it's from a study that that the NIST engineers conducted.
Four pictures in the folder. I can't hear anything.
Okay, I must have messed up when I sent the folder to you. It didn't have the pictures that I thought it did. My apologies.
Yeah.
So we can go to you. People can go to your website, cinemaquestinc.com, and see this information. But go on and describe what we're talking about then.
NIST did some consumer product research and studied flat panel displays and the interaction of light in the room, and produced these two graphics. One shows how there are a variety of different kinds of light interference, either a very distinct, recognizable reflection, like a table lamp, or in their case, in the graphic, they use a mini mag light flashlight with the head taken off of it, and it's just a little bulb.
So the bare light bulb, yeah. By the way, and, John, those two graphics are PDFs; they're not JPEGs. So,
and you've got a very you can do a very sharp reflection or kind of a fuzzy, hazy ball of reflection, like a hot spot. If there is an anti-glare coating on the screen, or if there's just general light in the room, it can cause what's called a Lambertian reflection, which basically takes over the whole surface of the screen and puts a diffused haze over all of it. And then there are various combinations. And the second graphic is a representation of several flat panel TVs with individual and combinations of those principles of reflection. And it's very educational about how light can interfere with the picture. Ah, here we go.
And now we have them, thanks to John, our wonderful engineer, who made good on my mistake of sending him PDFs. So let's take a look at those real quick here. The first one that you just had up was the reflective characteristics. Here's a little mag light with the top taken off, so it's a bare bulb. And we don't need to see the text. We can sort of zoom in on the actual graphics if we can. Maybe that's not so easy.
There we go.
Thank you very much. Okay, so Lambertian or Lambertian is a very diffuse reflection. It goes everywhere, all over the place. You don't see a particular spot. If there's a bright light, it gets reflected all over the place and very diffusely, very evenly. Whereas a specular reflection, the second one there, is very well defined. You just basically see a reflection like in a mirror, right?
Yes.
And then the third type is called haze, which looks like you're looking at the bulb through a haze, so it's very aptly named. And then we have some other different variations of that in more technical terms.
Combinations,
yes. So the second graphic that we have, the PDF, shows what it looks like on the screen of a flat panel TV with different types of lighting that may or may not work very well. The dark room image, it obviously looks the best because there is no light in the room. It's a dark room, which is certainly how I watch TV. But a lot of people can't tolerate that, either because of the spousal acceptance factor, right? The spouse doesn't want a black hole for a room to watch TV in, or it might be that the TV's in a multi-purpose room and the kids are playing in the corner or grandma's knitting in the other corner or whatever, and they need some light. So what we see here is the effect of different types of lighting in the room on the flat panel. Alan, why don't you describe a little bit about what we're seeing here in these four images, these four simulations of flat panels in a room?
It's showing different combinations of the Lambertian and specular and haze components. And surely all of us have, I know, don't call you Shirley, Many of us have seen these combinations in our own homes and are familiar with it, but may not have put it all together when it comes time to watch a serious program, say a movie that you really care a lot about that you watch maybe once every couple of years and you just love the film and you want to see every little nuance of detail and subtlety that the cinematographer produced. Having light in the room will interfere with the picture in various ways. And in my home theater, in my house, we have a torchiere lamp, which is the only lamp in the room that we use. It reflects off the ceiling. And then we have a bias light behind the television. I have a 50-inch plasma, and it is very reflective. And when we watch television, everyone in the house, my wife, my son, my dog and I, all notice that as you dim the torchiere lamp, the richness of the picture on the TV just comes out. And even the slightest little bit of light in the room can affect our perception of how good the picture looks. This is really twofold. One is the reflection issues. The other involves how our vision adapts to various lighting, ambient lighting conditions, both outdoors and indoors, and our ability to perceive the quality of an image changes as the ambient light changes. In the case where, like in a movie theater, a commercial cinema, where people go in and it gets very dark, or in a home cinema that may even get darker, it can take up to a half an hour for our human visual system to fully adapt to that lower light level. And just like when we're driving at night into traffic on the highway, the more these headlights come at us over and over and over and over again at random intervals, we start to experience eye strain or viewing fatigue, and it can be quite dangerous for people who drive all night on the highway if they start to get drowsy and so on. But they're
because their eyes are continually readapting all the
right.
time,
constantly shifting and changing, and for the human visual system to completely adapt to a dark room, there are electrical and chemical changes that occur in the retina of the eye, and then as well as the most people understand the changing of the iris and how it opens and closes according to how much light is in the room. But there are other factors that go into our adaptive mechanisms visually when ambient light changes. And when we're in a dark room watching most video programs, in order to retain interest, the director will change from scene to scene. And oftentimes you'll go from a dark scene to a light scene. Next time you're watching broadcast television, a typical show, if you will turn your back to the TV in a dark room, you'll see the whole room just light up in flashes like a strobe light. And this is erratic and it's constant through most video programs. And that has that similar effect upon our viewing fatigue and eye strain that driving into oncoming traffic at night does.
So this leads us naturally to the idea of a bias light. And there have been a number of people in the chat room already who have been asking about the bias light. And I know that that's a particular interest of yours. So tell us what a bias light is and how that helps this process.
Bias lighting biases or moderates, regulates the human visual system so that you're not subjected to these extremes when you watch TV in a dark room. TVs typically are built, designed, intended, engineered to be able to compete with high ambient light levels. They come from the womb set up for running very bright to compete with high ambient light. Because most consumers aren't concerned about image fidelity, they're more concerned about convenience and information and entertainment with all the lights on or during the day, and they want their TV to be able to compete adequately with high ambient light levels. Well, when you put a device that is built for high ambient light and you put it in a dark room, oftentimes you can't even dim it down far enough to the point where it won't cause eye strain because of that erratic changes in brightness effect and just the fact of having this bright object constantly in our field of view and in the dark. And so bias lighting biases our human visual system by introducing a little bit of ambient light, about 10% of the brightest light the TV puts out when it's calibrated for the dark room, when it's adjusted for dark room viewing, and gives us a little bit of a threshold or a noise floor, to put it in audio terms, where it gives us about 10% ambient light in the room. So our vision is not having to traverse such a broad scale of adaptability from dark scenes in the programming to the brighter scenes in the programming.
Now, SoCal Ray Jr. in the chat room is saying it also helps improve your display's perceived black level.
And contrast. An interesting study that I include quotes on my website from a couple of imaging experts have found that when you introduce ambient lighting in a darker viewing environment with an electronic display, either a computer screen or a television, when you introduce that ambient light, it has an effect on how we perceive the dark areas of the image, but not the bright areas of the image. So the result being that our perception of dynamic range is enhanced. And dynamic range is always a desirable element in picture quality to enhance whenever possible in whatever way we can in almost all cases. So this is a side benefit of bias lighting that is seldom understood or discussed in the hobbyist communities. They almost always stop at eye strain, but it's been proven and demonstrated, and there are demonstrations on the eChalk site as well of how when you surround an image with a lighter field, the dark areas look darker and the bright areas stay about where they are, and you get a broader dynamic range of light to dark perceived. Mm-hmm.
Now, this isn't only limited to home theaters. We have a photo of a color correction suite in which there is a bias light being used. I believe this is at Dolby somewhere. There it is.
Yeah, that's a Dolby reference monitor in the middle.
It's a Dolby reference monitor. It's not at Dolby.
Right. And I've collected a bunch of these that technicians have sent me over the years, because more and more we're getting orders from the professional ranks. And there are a lot of professional color correction artists or colorists who understand the necessity of having a neutral surround and the right white point of ambient light, which is D65 or more commonly referred to as 6,500 kelvins. And right, this is a this is a nice example of a very well-executed system with the Dolby monitor. I like the image because Dolby Labs called and asked me to advise them on how to implement our professional bias light into a portable setup when they were developing this monitor. This is a $30,000 42-inch LCD panel that's, I think, 16 inches thick and weighs 150 pounds, not your typical LCD flat panel.
No, and in fact, I also happen to know that it uses full array backlighting, LED backlighting, in which each of the individual LEDs in the backlight are independently dimmable. They aren't in groups or zones. The zones consist of one LED rather than several. So that's one reason why it's so expensive.
It's a marvelous display.
It really is incredible. And you can see in this picture the there is some light around surrounding the picture, the display itself. That light is behind the panel, which is where you would want to put the bias light.
Right, because then you don't have those reflection issues.
Now, people are going to ask, and if they haven't already, I can't see it in the chat room at the moment. Philips made something some time ago, and they may still do it, I don't really know, called Ambilight, which for the most part was very silly. Basically, it was a ring of LEDs around the back of the panel, and they would light or dim depending on the picture. And for the most part, they're set to change colors with the color of the picture. And I thought that was silly, but they also are, you can set them to a particular color of white and a steady constant illumination or brightness, and it could act as a bias light, which I thought was a great idea.
The early versions weren't very accurate. They actually used cold cathode fluorescent tubes, and then they changed to LED. And I do believe it's still a feature available on their top models in Europe. They pulled out of the U.S. market some time ago. And interestingly enough, they actually used some quotes from my website in their original marketing materials, which they changed later when I started pointing that out. And what they were doing with the colored stuff was something apparently the marketing department dreamed up. I doubt the engineers recommended it, but they essentially gave people a party mode or some other way they could show off to other people how fancy their TV was. But essentially, when you add colored light behind the TV while you're watching a program, you get that subtractive distortion perceptually of what's in the picture. So it actually...
Which we were talking about before, yeah.
Right. It distorts the quality of the picture that you're watching.
Right. But if you can take that ambilight and fix it at the right color of white, and I want to make sure we all understand that it's important that the bias light behind the TV be at this particular color of white called D65, and at a brightness of about 10% of the maximum amount of light that the TV can produce. If you can set that ambilight to those parameters, it's a very effective bias light, and it works really well in that capacity, don't you think?
It'll actually improve how the image looks on the screen rather than distorting it.
Yeah, yeah, amazing. Well, we got more to talk about in terms of bias lighting. But before we do, I do have one more sponsor to thank for being a sponsor of this podcast. And that, of course, is Ting. Now, Ting is a mobile phone service, which is basically a reseller of the Sprint network. But it's no BS. And I'm talking no BS here because there are no contracts. There are no early termination fees. You don't have to worry about any of that stuff. And in fact, they have a new early termination fee or ETF relief program. If you have to pay an ETF to switch over to Ting, they've got your back. They'll credit up to 25% of your ETF up to $75 per device. Simply purchase your device through Ting, port your number over, and then submit your final bill with the ETF detail from your previous carrier, and they will help you take care of it. It's amazing. Go to ting.com/ETF for more information on this great, great feature that they offer. There are no bundling or ride-along services. Rates range XS through XXL service levels for voice minutes, text messages, and megabytes of data, all billed separately. This is very important. There are no overage charges, no penalties. You just pay for what you use in each of those three categories. No add-on charges. You get voicemail, caller ID, tethering, hotspot, three-way calling, call forwarding, all sorts of other services that are all no additional charge, which means there's no mysterious line items on your bill. Ting just charges for what you use, but there are no hidden charges or recovery fees or other BS. In fact, you can have unlimited devices on a single plan. And each device on a plan costs a flat $6 a month. There's also a powerful online account control panel, which lets you take control of your account, your usage, and your bills very, very easily and very intuitively. They also have no-hold customer support. Dig this. Call them at 1-855-TING-FTW anytime between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and a real person will pick up the phone. When was the last time that happened when you tried to call customer support? They also have excellent online support, too. Go to help.ting.com, and they've got all sorts of customer forums, a simple and powerful help ticketing system, video tutorials, video startup guides, all kinds of great stuff there. First, you purchase your mobile device from Ting, which you'll receive in 2 to 5 business days. Then you activate your device with Ting, and you have the option to select a new phone number or port the existing one. Ting will break your rates down by minutes, text messages, and megabytes, and bill you at the end of the month just for what you've used. So visit Ting today at htg.ting.com. Save money and better manage your mobile phone usage with Ting, and check out their savings calculator and see how much you or your company can save. Home Theater Geeks viewers can also save $25 on your first Ting device when you sign up. So visit htg.ting.com and start saving today. And we thank Ting very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks and the entire TWiT network. So, Alan Brown, founder and president of CinemaQuest, Inc., we've been talking about bias lighting, and I've got a question here in the chat room, which is very appropriate, which is, what brand and model of bias light would you recommend for a 60-inch TV? Now, of course, CinemaQuest makes bias lights. In fact, I have one behind my plasma as well. Tell us about what the ones that you make.
How convenient.
Indeed.
Well, you know, when you asked me to come on, I was thinking that I would enjoy educating people more than selling them stuff. But since I am a business person and I do make these bias lights, people can go to my website. We have two consumer models and one professional model. And actually, the consumer models are being used by professionals. We got an order for 11 Idealume panel lights from Technicolor New York a couple of weeks back. They've been ordering these repeatedly, a number of their divisions, because they use them in less color critical color correction environments, but they still want to have the best image quality on their monitors around the studio and so on. So they've been using the consumer models and using the professional models for their most scientifically precise and color critical applications.
What difference is there between the consumer and the professional models?
Well, the consumer is a lightweight, ultra-slim a model that uses a 3-phosphor fluorescent tube. The professional model is quite heavy. It's heavy gauge steel. It's made in the U.S., so it costs us quite a bit more to have these fixtures made. Much beefier ballast, much more durable, and has a 3 times the warranty period as the consumer models. And the lamp that's used in it is a special patented 7-phosphor fluorescent formula that Greytag Macbeth developed years ago and have maintained the patent on. And it's an incredibly accurate D65 illuminant that's just very difficult to replace. We used to have a model that used a metal halide lamp that was more accurate, but it was as hot as the sun, and it was not suitable for bias lighting at all. It was a task lamp that was used for very brief periods of time because it got so hot. And this is the next best D65 illuminant in the world that we have been able to find, and we've been maintaining our research and development and a product updating and so on for 15 years, and it's still the best out there. And that's in the pro model, which is much more expensive than the consumer model. But the consumer model is also used by people who know what they're doing and have a high regard for doing it correctly on a tighter budget.
And by the way, we should say that the name of this product is Ideal Lume, I-D-E-A-L-U-M-E, right?
I-D-A-L hyphen L-U-M-E.
And Ideal Lume, yeah.
We have another URL which we have registered that's ideal-lume.com that will get you to our site as well as cinemaquestinc.com.
Got it. Undermine in the chat room is asking, would it be economically feasible or better even to use quantum dot LEDs as opposed to fluorescent tubes, which you use now, which is related to the question I was going to ask, which is what about using LEDs as opposed to fluorescent lights?
We've been looking at LED for a number of years, and it's not quite there yet. The LEDs that are white LEDs that are high color rendering have been very expensive. They have to be bin matched and set aside, especially for a high color rendering application. And we've had difficulty finding suppliers. You're starting to see a lot of these higher CRI color rendering index LEDs in the cinema industry, movie making industry. Studios are using them, but they're thousands of dollars for a light fixture. And the red, green, blue triplet and red, green, blue combination LED products that are out there, because the we're getting kind of technical here, but because the bandwidth the is so narrow, the spectral bandwidth of the individual primaries, because the bandwidth is so narrow, there are so many colors that look strange under them when you're in between the red, green, and blue spectral points. And it's been very difficult to get a satisfying, correct-looking white from an RGB combination with LEDs. The white LEDs are essentially native blue-white LEDs that Derek Smith mentioned this in your last program that I watched, that they insert some yellow phosphor because LED diodes produce ultraviolet light in the UV spectrum when they light up, and that excites the yellow phosphor, and that color corrects the blueness of the native blue-white LEDs. It pulls the blue out and it evens out the color, but there are still problems in the red and especially in the cyan portion of the spectrum, and they just don't have the color rendering quality of what you can get in a white fluorescent at 6,500 kelvins, more easily and much cheaper, much more cheaply in the market. But we're still working on LEDs. We would like to see that developed in the future, but the industry has just been changing and growing and R&D at a very fast pace, and new solutions are coming out all the time.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. We've run out of time, unfortunately. There's a lot more to talk about, but it just means I'll have to get you back on the show to continue our discussion about the room as video component. Thanks so much for being on, Alan.
Thank you for having me.
As we've said, you can find more information at CinemaQuestInc.com or ideal-loom.com. And there's plenty of information there. And I also invite you to go check out the eChalk site, eChalk.co.uk. For those optical illusions that we took a look at. Those are, I think, really cool. You can always find me online, of course, at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott, also at avsforum. You can always find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks as well right here on twit.tv/htg. Or on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twithometheatergeeks. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be C.H. Chi at DVDO, talking all about wireless HDMI. So I'm really looking forward to that, and I hope you will join me then. Until then, geek out!